Welcome to Missing Persons Uncovered. I'm Caroline Humer, a child protection expert, and in this podcast series, we seek to understand the complexities of a global issue. Every year, hundreds of thousands of people go missing worldwide.
I'm Karen Shalev, and I carry out research into missing persons at the University of Portsmouth in the UK. Across this series, Caroline and I are talking to professionals to share insights into how we can all be more aware and take actions to protect vulnerable people in our communities and families from going missing.
Hello and welcome everyone. Today we will be talking about trauma therapy and some innovative interventions and use of art in supporting the families of missing persons. And I have a very special guest today, Pascal Wachnik. Tell us how you got into this field and a little bit about you.
I'm French, as you can notice, and I've been training in psychology and psychotherapy after working for the last 20 years in diverse roles, from project manager to HR manager in the public and private sector in the UK. I really got interested in the field of missing people because my mum went missing 10 years ago. She had Alzheimer's and she was never found. And this really left lasting wounds that we're still struggling to heal after those 10 years. And getting support at the time was quite challenging because in France, there was no support. And in the UK, where I was living, I was not eligible for support because my mum went missing in France. So it was very, very difficult because we didn't get any advice on how to get support, on how to search, on what to do with the media, and what to do to extend the search. And it was just really challenging just to keep going. But it's only when I was doing my reflective journal, when I was doing my dissertation on missing people, that I realized that actually I had had other members of my family going missing previously because of mental and physical health. And I just didn't put the puzzle together until that point.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the dissertation? Because we will get into that a little bit. Yeah. What was it that you specialized in?
My dissertation was really on psychology and how we can trying to understand the needs of the families of missing people and how we can better help them and support them. That was done at the University of West London. And the study gathered the insights of 39 people, families of missing people, that either participated in a brainstorming workshop on needs, a collage focus group, or life narrative interviews. And this research shed light on the anguish and the distress, the moral injury that families are dealing through when someone they love is going missing. And moral injury was a concept that was not really applied to that field until now. But it's something that really could inform how organizations can better support the family.
Just to remind listeners, we talked in quite a lot of depth about the needs of families in series one, and you can listen to that first, or you can come and listen to this episode without the previous knowledge. But I think it's really important to, first of all, identify that relationship between trauma and having someone you love going missing. Yeah. Can you summarize that a little bit for us from the literature?
Maybe it's useful to explain what trauma is, because the word traumatic is really often used as a synonym for stressful. And anyone who has gone through a traumatic experience firsthand can tell you that it has nothing to do with stress. It's really not the same thing. And because stress is really your body's reaction to unexpected events, but that require an adjustment or response. And the key distinction is that traumatic experience can endanger a life. Experiencing or seeing a situation where actual death or significant injury is possible or perceived as possible is traumatic, like someone going missing, really. And when you realize that someone is gone missing, you feel a sense of panic, of fear, of helplessness, and of horror. And often there will be that sense that I'm not being in control, being completely overwhelmed. And then it doesn't really make any sense. You feel confused and it might be really, really distressing. And the first contacts with the police might also be quite stressful, frankly, because the questions by nature of an investigation are intrusive. And it might make the family feel as if they are doubted. And the investigation sometimes might reveal things that the family was not aware of about the missing person. And it might be quite anxiety provoking because the police investigation aims at establishing the risk to the person. They might ask the family to imagine why the person might have gone missing and to think of reason why they went missing. And it might be the only thing that the family really can do to really help the investigation. And it might provoke this loop of obsessive thoughts, because you have to find the reason why and to find clues of where they might be. It might be really difficult to stop having the person always in your mind, even if they are not physically there, and to stop ruminating about the situations and how and what might have happened. Also, the search is really traumatic. I mean, it might involve a lot of people, which is fantastic. People give up their time to help, and that's something that is really generous of them. But having helicopters, search dogs, all that is quite traumatic in itself, because you realize that if such heavy means are deployed, it means it's really difficult to find a person. And it might feel like you are transported into a film set. It's really surreal because it feels like a nightmare you don't know the rules of, you can't predict the outcomes of, and it's all about your loved ones. It's really that initial search might be really bringing you into a limbo state where you feel blocked. And after that, life might feel like it's on hold. And because you're living through ambiguous loss, uncertainty, ambiguity, and because the loss is not resolved, it might feel like you are in a roller coaster of emotions. It's very painful and difficult to make plans or to leave your house even. In addition, the disappearance might bring about administrative, legal, financial problems that you might have to juggle with. For instance, you might not have access to the joint account anymore, and you might not be able to pay bills. So all these can induce sleeping problems, panic attacks, intrusive thoughts, and hypervigilance, and communication problems, and disputes with other members of your family. And it's because trauma pierces our resilience, our previously tried and tested coping mechanism. So it goes beyond our personal, family, and community psychosocial resilience. And really, it attacks our fundamental assumptions about the world, that the world is essentially a good place, that life and events have meaning and purpose, that we are valuable and worthy, and that good things happen to good people. Because a person going missing is a loss that is not like a normal death, people around you can't really relate to this experience and might ask painful questions to you. It might be difficult for other people to know what to say, what to do, and it might feel really isolating. In addition to that, you've got memories of trauma that are distressing because they are emotionally charged and they contradict our fundamental assumption about the nature of reality. So your responses to trauma may be just a way to deal with what is not a normal situation. And it's completely normal to react this way because you simply have been through a traumatic experience.
And what is moral injury?
So moral injury is not new. It's a concept that was used for a long time in the military for veterans coming back from war. But moral injury is the psychological harm that we might experience about the wrongness of a situation when poor decisions are made either by us, others, or those in leadership positions in high-stake situations, which contradict our moral code. And our moral code is our set of beliefs about the world, what the world should be, and what's right and what's wrong. So the difference between trauma and moral injury is that trauma is a fear and threat-based problem, whereas moral injurious events or situation threatens our deeply held beliefs and trust. It's not a mental illness. So if we look at families and the experience of families, for moral injury to the self, we can see that the impact of the legitimate unpreparedness of the family and not being able to protect and find your loved one, the lack of control and not knowing forces relative to renegotiate who they were, their self-identity. And they often feel as if they have failed in their role. And because the pain never leaves and diminishes, there's a lot of vulnerability and entrapment of the self, left without futures to be told, without exit to their agony. So it leaves a void that the relative can only fill with all the scenarios that they are imagining. It's really like a roller coaster of emotions and somehow a mental torture of uncertainty. And when we look at moral injury from others, this might expose them to facts that might contravene their impression of safety of their surrounding. So the world is seen as a dangerous place where someone can go missing and not being found, where someone can be attacked, or all scenarios are open at this stage. And the lack of witness account or false witness account adds to that sense of rupture and suspicion that others are not always there with the best intentions as they thought. So the sense of others don't care that is exacerbated by cyberbullying, false accounts, people profiting from the distress of others. And for children, there might be a particular risk of bullying. There's that sense that they can't open up or discuss that within the family nucleus. So all this lack of support from the community around them leaves wounds that are hard to heal. And this represents an isolating experience that feels like a label, a new identity they didn't choose. And they find it hard to discuss or to talk about it within the family. And as I said, the children particularly might suffer a lot from the silence. When we look at moral injury from institution, betrayal, depending on the situation, the police might decide that actually it's the right of the person to disappear if they are an adult and they have no vulnerability. So the families are left without recourse to such on their own. And they might really feel let down, like nobody really cares about their loved ones. And in addition to that, families feel that sense of being at the mercy of the services, that sense that the police forces are not only ill-prepared to conduct investigation, but also not showing the expected professional curiosity and empathy. I think empathy is really important in that sense that you've got a person who's looking for the best outcome. And the frustration is high at the police within my sample because they didn't feel that they were listened to and that the knowledge they had about the missing person was really taken into account. And this pushes families to conduct their own investigation, which can be traumatizing by itself. And because the families know that a lot of inequalities in resource allocation between cases, they feel really betrayed by that. There's that sense of violation of trust from organizations they thought they could rely on. And because they are completely at the mercy of their help to help them find the person missing. Also, sometimes when the investigation starts, anyone will be taken as a potential perpetrator by the police. So it can feel really distressing, especially when you're going through trauma yourself.
When I heard you speak the first time, I was really taken by the use of art in understanding those complex emotions and experiences. We are very verbal beings. We like to talk about things and we like people to ask us questions. And the reason why we wanted to do this episode is really to think about other innovative ways and the use of art in understanding how families feel and what they go through, but also in terms of what support they need or how we can facilitate through the use of art and different ways to release all of those emotions and that trauma. How can art be used to understand families and their trauma?
When someone has gone through trauma, it's normal for them to find it hard to use words to describe what they are feeling or to describe disturbing imagery. And it's difficult to process your emotions when you can't describe a disturbing thought. And because traumatic memories are encoded visually and somatically, creating art may be the most effective way to assess them. Art helps develop and connect different parts of the brain, and art and creative process can be used in many illnesses. It's used often with cancer patients, in mental health settings for chronic depression, anxiety disorders, in disaster relief and crisis intervention. So people can explore experiences using art as a form of coping, and it's likely to increase the trauma survivor's sense of empowerment as well. When you discharge your disturbing feelings or thoughts on paper or through dancing, music, using creative writing or creative expressions, it can help you change your focus. So quiet, ruminative and intrusive thoughts slow your breathing and help you visualize your thoughts and see them from different angles and perspectives. You can then represent what disturbs you inside, outside your mind, and as an object you can look at, making it feel more detached from you than when you have to talk about it. So it's very useful. And you don't have to be an artist. You don't have to be good at drawing or painting. You can use any means, collage or any crafts. And in general, it's the creative process that is important, not the art itself.
Art is certainly a powerful tool to express oneself. But where and how do you start the process?
Maybe take a question or take something that is disturbing you, a thought that is disturbing you, and trying to relax and take a piece of paper or take anything that you want and trying to let go of any pressure and just think of what you feel and write it or draw it on a piece of paper. You can stick pieces of papers as well to represent something. There's other techniques like drawing the silhouette of a body and maybe representing where the pain is, where your feelings and how your feelings look like in your body. Trying to really relate that to your sense of self. It's quite a free expression. You don't have to dictate what will come out. It's really what it's dictated by what comes from your emotions and what comes at the moment you're doing it. When I did the research, we did like a focus group where we did a collage. So participants would have a lot of pieces of magazines that they had cut out that they thought represented their story or represented how they felt. And what we were looking at is doing the journey into what it represented to have gone through the missing people, the missing experience, and how they felt the journey was going and what had helped them and what was not very helpful. Then it's your interpretation. And I think what is useful is to do that in groups, because then you can discuss why you're using that particular color, why you're using that particular image, and you can really open up discussions that are maybe deeper or are going in directions that you wouldn't reach through a normal structured interview.
Obviously, when we understand what is going on or what the needs are, then we know what support people then need. So what did you find were the key themes that came out from the work and from people's expression as to what their needs are and what support did they need the most?
People expressed a lot of difficulty towards support that had been provided by the police, social services, religious community, some community response work, family court, and even banks, for instance, with their lack of understanding of the law. That was really something that they struggled with. And when we looked at what was useful, what had been valuable for them, then school, counseling, doctors, victim support, housing, missing people, the charity, online support, phone calls, their children, partner, family and friends, and the wider local community were seen as being really useful, as well as media with the appeal and newspapers. So they felt that that was quite useful. And in terms of future support, so the relative of missing people thought that it would be useful to have better support from the police, more police liaison officers, speed in recovery of information such as CCTV camera, low land rescue, continued support from the media, from missing people, from friends, family, social workers, support from family workers, specialized counseling and mental health awareness. When we look at what works, we see that effective schools, connections to pro-social organizations, vital emergency and support services are community-led requirements for establishing resilience. Social support significantly and reliably decreases anxiety, depression, and regulates accumulative stress and enhancing therefore well-being and adaptation. I think it's very important that organizations understand that if they are involved with missing people, they have to take steps in reducing moral injury that they might cause, and to be aware of that, because by trying maybe to solve the mechanism or to trying to understand what contributed to it, because they might be responsible in contributing to the trauma response of families of missing people. And there are maybe easy steps to be taken. Maybe more sharing of data across agency would help as well in preventing missing people from going missing and aiding investigation. The investment in technology to obtain information of where the person might have gone missing is important. But it's really that responsibility in evaluating the risk of moral injury in their interventions that is important. And I think there's something to be said about the fact that there's something about individual traumatic events versus collective emergency response. And we are much better at strategic preparedness to support resilience and reduce risk planning and coordination of services and recovery after significant incidents and disaster. And maybe we need to apply some of this approach better, in a better way, in the individual missing case.
I just want to go back a little bit to the art, because obviously listeners can't see the art. If you can talk to us a little bit about the kind of expressions that that has led to, the things that you've seen and what they signified, just as examples to bring it to life a little bit.
During the dissertation with the participant, we produced some collage. And one was very impressive, I think, that it was very revealing, which was the image of that a participant created with collage of a sinking boat, whereby you could see the weight of the missing poster, the missing words on the shoulders of a sinking person, really, in the middle of the sea. And with a boat of support, which was carrying missing people, hope, mental health services, religious services, and friends and family, and with an anchor that was sinking the boat and which was represented by the police. And really that imagery was quite powerful because that's really how the participants I interviewed were feeling, that they couldn't move on because they were always dragged down by the police. And it's not an easy job that the police is doing, but there are maybe lessons to be learned and to improve the service and to improve especially the trust, because once the trust is violated, it's difficult to build it again. So it's very important to address that initially with that in mind, that there might be moral injury produced and impacting the families from the onset. I must say the art was very well welcomed. So I exhibited it at the Mental Health Scotland, and for the annual meeting of GPs, I had people coming to me saying, within a few minutes, I understood how the families were feeling. And people saying, this is the only thing I will remember from this conference. It has made an everlasting impact on me. I think there's a power in the art in engaging the humanity and translating humanity that other means don't have.
That's really powerful. I think we'll finish with that, because that's really the message that we want to send out, to think creatively and to think about different ways of expression that can release those emotions and release that trauma. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Missing Persons Uncovered. And thank you, Pascal Washnik, for sharing your insight into trauma-informed care for families and returned missing persons. Please check out her research and any resources on this topic on our website.
If you have any questions you would like us to answer or thoughts on topics you would like us to discuss, please contact us through our website. If you'd like specific information or need help, please reach out to your local police department or national charity. If you are enjoying this podcast and discussion, please help support us by buying us a coffee through missingpersonsuncovered.com.
I'm Karen Shalev.
And I'm Caroline Humer. Thank you for listening. Join us next time when we talk to Simona Capitaro about how social media has changed missing person posters distribution and the media biased.